Big Finish present Doctor Who, Short Trips. All Hands on Deck by Eddie Robson. Read by Carol Ann Ford. After everything, I ended up back at Coal Hill School. It hadn't been a school for a long time. They converted it into flats over 100 years ago. The building had more or less survived the first Dalek invasion, but there was so much work to do to get it habitable again, nobody got round to it before the second invasion hit. It had just been reopened when I was looking for a new place, somewhere smaller. I didn't need the space anymore. I could hardly say no when I realised it was available. It had always been a lovely old building, and now the playground had been torn up and a garden planted there. And in the quad, in the middle of the school, years and years ago, someone had planted an oak tree in memory of Ian and Barbara. It didn't say when they died. The plaque had obviously been replaced more than once, but the tree was a huge, gnarled and knotted thing. They'd had to cut it back when they renovated the place, as it had grown through several of the windows and caused a lot of damage. But I'm glad they didn't cut it down. Only a couple of the other flats were occupied, so it was quiet, but I didn't mind that. My flat was on the ground floor. Small, 3 rooms. I didn't have a lot of things. And the main room had previously been a classroom, where almost 250 years ago I'd been taught English. I remember quite clearly one afternoon when I sat by the window, which was now in my kitchen, reading the part of Cordelia from King Lear, along with the class, and confidently told the teacher, Miss Ireland, that this was nothing like what had really happened, and being told I was missing the point. And I was standing by that same window at 3:38 in the morning in late October, making myself some tea, when the emergency call came in. We'd used a lot of salvaged Dalek technology in the process of getting ourselves back on our feet, mostly making use of their power generators and chemical synthesizers, and I'd been helping to make it compatible with what they had on Earth. Even then, the technology was security equipped to resist being used by anyone who wasn't a Dalek. And although I'd hoped to move on to other projects by now, instead I was still spending a lot of my time tinkering with the equipment, hoping I could get it to work better. The synthesizer I'd been working on earlier that day was set up in a warehouse in King's Cross, suspended in a web of virtual cable routers, which could simulate the necessary Dalek commands. The upshot of the rather panicked call I received was that the synthesizer was doing things nobody had ever seen it do before. Its data output had gone haywire, and it was draining energy from the local systems in huge waves. Also, it was glowing purple. I said I'd come straight away. They'd already sent a bubble to my flat. I got dressed, went outside, and it was ready to collect me. On the way to King's Cross, I wondered if this was the reason why I'd been awake. I didn't need as much sleep as humans, but I kept to a regular pattern of 4 or 5 hours each night. Usually I closed my eyes and fell asleep in moments, but that night I'd lain awake for hours, gripped by a vague, uneasy feeling. Perhaps this was the cause. I didn't think it was precognition or anything like that, but I did wonder if maybe there was some presence here that had disturbed my equilibrium somehow. When I arrived, I tried to look like I knew what I was doing. Grandfather had often done this when he walked into a crisis, because people in a crisis always want to see someone who knows what they're doing. If you seem like you're the only one who knows how to fix things, people are less likely to shoot you. Not that anyone here was likely to shoot me. These were all colleagues, but I did need them to calm down. The synthesizer was an inverted cone, about 4 meters high, and housed in a space at the center of the warehouse. It was indeed glowing purple, and just from the sound it was making, it was obvious its energy intake was all over the place. 5 people were working at the controls we'd set up, trying to work out what was causing this. I asked to be shown the data output, and Dr. Elsa McCrow, who was in charge of this facility, brought it up for me. Goodness, I said, as the code streamed past my eyes. I know, said Elsa. I watched it a little longer. Whatever it's trying to make, it's complex, not a simple compound. Does it match anything in the database we pulled off before we cleaned its programming? Elsa shook her head. And this hasn't come from us. I knew what she was getting at. If nobody here had set this running, it must have been some dormant data the synthesizer had on it somewhere. It had probably been triggered by my tampering. I should have left the stupid thing alone. And before I could even suggest any action we could take, the purple glow dropped, and an output hatch opened on the side of the synthesizer. What on earth was going to come out of it? It had never occurred to me before now, but the hatch was easily the height of a Dalek. The room was gripped by tension. I didn't even know if we should evacuate. Shouldn't we wait and find out what we were dealing with first? It seemed everyone else was thinking the same thing, because none of them moved, and we all watched the hatch as it started pumping out a viscous yellow fluid. We all jumped back as the fluid slopped through the virtual cable net and hit the floor, splattering a radius of a couple of meters. Involuntarily, people yelped. More of the stuff followed, forming a bright pool which oozed across the floor. There was much agitated speculation on what it actually was. A chemical weapon? Would it eat through the floor? Was it some kind of artificial primordial soup which would give rise to more of the creatures who'd built this machine? But I realized the smell of it was familiar, deeply so. Wait, I said, and held up a hand. I edged closer to the stuff, waving away their warnings, and dipped a finger in it. My flesh didn't dissolve, so that was a good start. I took a closer look, and then I licked it. It was custard. After a few minutes, the machine stopped spewing it out, although not before most of the floor was covered. I stayed to help clean it up. The smell transported me back to lunchtimes at Coal Hill, sitting apart from the other pupils, watching them and listening, but not knowing how to join in. They littered their conversations with references I couldn't understand. That's why I used to listen to the radio so much, and I'd read the pop magazines, trying to find a way in. Of course, by the summer, it was all about the Beatles, and I'd heard of them at least. But even then I'd get mixed up and accidentally mention songs they hadn't written yet. The others just thought I didn't know what I was talking about. Still, I loved the band's vitality and optimism. It was as if they knew their moment was just round the corner, and I wanted to stay and share it with them. I'd arrived at exactly the right time. But Grandfather never understood that. By the time the floor was clean, it was morning. I stayed at the facility for the rest of the day, trying to work out what had gone wrong with the synthesizer and what we could do to stop it happening again. But we didn't have much luck. The synthesizer's data logs had no record of the incident at all, and they didn't contain the chemical structure of the custard or anything remotely like it. Had it suffered a malfunction and generated custard by pure chance? It was possible, but the odds were very long indeed. I returned home late, and as I walked through the living room, suddenly my eyes started watering and I sneezed. It was like having hay fever, only I don't get hay fever. I made myself another tea and went to bed. I was alone with my thoughts in Coal Hill School, just like I'd been on those lunchtimes all those years ago. Everyone I'd been close to was gone. There were still people I saw regularly and liked, but I didn't think there was anyone I'd count as a friend. 2 days later, I was at home going through the synthesizer's code base in more detail, trying to find traces of the commands which had made it go haywire when I received another call. An asteroid had been detected on collision course with the Earth. It was less than 4 hours away. Again, they sent a bubble, and I was brought to the Airspace Command Center in Greenwich. To their credit, everyone was being very businesslike. We had procedures in place to deal with such things, and missiles designed specifically for deflecting and breaking up asteroids. Everyone was generally more unsettled by the fact that we hadn't picked it up sooner. We should have known about this months, even years in advance, which was the main reason I'd been called in. With my experience of life away from Earth, they wanted to ask me if it might be something other than an asteroid. I looked at the data myself, but there didn't seem to be much doubt. As the moment of launch approached, there was tension in the room. The asteroid's existence hadn't been publicly revealed, and although I understood the reasons for keeping it under wraps, I didn't feel entirely comfortable about it. What if we failed? Didn't people have a right to know what was happening and make their own choices about how they spent their last afternoon on Earth? Not that I thought we would fail. We had the tools to deal with this, and we would. We completed our preparations, the clock counted down, and there was nothing left to do except stare at the screen, as if staring at it would change it. And then, with 18 seconds to go before the missiles launched, the screen changed. Not because we were staring at it, of course, it just changed. The launch was suspended whilst we checked and double-checked. But there was nothing there. The asteroid had vanished. We had to make very sure. If we were wrong, we couldn't just wait for it to hit us. But there was no doubt. There was nothing coming. And, in my opinion, there never had. The fact we hadn't picked it up until such a late stage, and it then never arrived, suggested there was no asteroid at all. But the appearance of it had been fully convincing, fooling every detection system we had. It was no accident. This was my real cause for concern. If someone had done this deliberately, why? Did they want to see how we'd react, or how fast? Or were they trying to distract us from something else? I shared my concerns with those in command, but I had no insight to offer. I returned home again, and again I had that hay fever feeling. I wondered if there was a problem with my air conditioning. The next morning, the spiders came. I saw them before I heard anything about them. I was walking in the park, as I try to do most days, and one of them fell from a tree. It wasn't large. It was bigger than my hand, but not much bigger. It was certainly partly mechanical and seemed partly organic. It was black and orange, and the sunlight shone off its shiny body and legs. As it turned out, it also moved very fast. In a split second, it had covered the ground between the tree and my foot. It was almost on me, but I kicked out and it flew back, hitting a low branch of the tree and falling to the ground. For a moment it lay on its back, legs flailing in the air. But then it flipped over and came for me again. I started running in the opposite direction, not as fast as I used to be, and the spider was faster. It leapt onto my back. I shrugged off my coat and threw it to the ground. A lump in the middle of the coat twitched. The thing was trying to get out from under there, but it was struggling to do so. Whatever it had been designed to do, getting out from under a raincoat wasn't it. A young man who'd been walking in the park had seen my struggle. He dashed over, pulled a handgun, and was about to shoot the wriggling lump, but I stopped him. "Just stop it getting away," I said, and put my feet on the edges of the coat. "You're afraid of spoiling your coat?" he said, incredulously. "No," I said, and indicated for him to do the same as me. I didn't have time to explain to him, but he was good enough to do as he was told, standing on the other end of my coat in a way that would hopefully keep the thing captive. In the meantime, I reached into my bag and pulled out a small, slim device. I grabbed its control, twitched it to turn it on, and then pointed it at the coat and twitched it again. There was a slight kickback as a pulse emitted from the device with a dull zapping sound. The lump in the coat gave one last burst of movement, then it stopped. "What did you do?" asked the young man. "Binary feedback oscillator," I said, holding my device up. Since the second invasion, few of us felt confident that the same would not happen again. This fear never really left us, and many of us always carried weapons when we left the house. He had his handgun, but that was never really my style. Instead, I carried this. It was a simple gadget, with a pretty short range, but it would knock out most things based on electronic circuits. In theory, it would work on a Dalek. Half of me wanted the chance to test it, and half of me didn't. I'm Susan Campbell, by the way. Neither name was mine. I'd got them from other people. But they'd come to mean a lot to me, so I kept on using them. I shook his hand, and he introduced himself as Idrissa Diallo. We peeled back my coat carefully, in case the spider was still active, but it seemed completely inert. However, we both heard the commotion from outside the park, and it was clear that this was not the only one of its kind. Both suitably armed, we headed back towards the street. The spiders swarmed across the road. Some people huddled in corners and whatever buildings they could get access to. Others were trying to destroy the things with whatever weapons they had. This wasn't easy. They moved too fast for you to get a clear sight. And I momentarily felt a little pride at how Mr. Diallo and I had neutralized one so quickly. I prepared my oscillator, but I took a moment to watch the spiders' movements. It really wasn't clear what their purpose was. They seemed just to be scuttling around very fast. Were they trying to collect data? Or maybe they were lacking instructions? They certainly didn't seem intelligent, which meant I had no compunction about activating the oscillator and taking out several dozen of them at a single stroke. The street fell silent. People began to emerge. They wanted to know what I'd just done, so I explained, and they wanted to know what the creatures were, but I couldn't help them there. I still had the first one I'd stopped bundled in my coat. If I could analyze the thing, maybe I could find out something about where it had come from. The closest place to do that was back at my flat, which was only a few minutes' walk away. But then Mr. Diallo pointed back in the direction we'd come from. More of the spiders were coming across the park towards us, and I'd blasted so many with the oscillator, it was almost out of charge. I yelled for the crowd to follow me. If they came back to Coal Hill, I thought I could keep them safe while I worked out what was going on. We went as quickly as we could, helping each other when one of the things caught up with us. There were more of us than there were them, for now at least, and if we didn't panic, we could tackle them. In the garden outside the school, I could see more of the things moving. There were rather a lot of them. I told anyone with a weapon to put it on low power to avoid any accidents, and we swept through the garden towards the door, taking them out as we went. The security system identified me, but it wanted to know who all my guests were. I overrode it by putting it into the emergency setting. Despite our best efforts, some of the spiders managed to get in with us, and we picked these off once the door was closed. I had key codes for all the empty flats in the building, so I opened them up and told people to make their way inside and rest. Then I went into my own flat. I needed to report what was happening and start examining the spider I'd caught. I opened the door, walked into the kitchen, put the spider on the kitchen table, and then I saw someone. Out of the corner of my eye, someone who'd tried to hide under the shelf in the alcove by the window, only to discover it wasn't quite deep enough to hide him properly. I didn't know what he was planning to do. Maybe just stay as still as possible and hope I didn't notice. I just picked up the nearest thing, an electric whisk, and brandished it without thinking how it might work as a weapon. Then I saw who it was, and I realised that if I'd stopped to give it even half a second's thought, I'd have worked it out. "Grandfather," I said. He stepped out of the alcove, smiling broadly, as if he wasn't stepping out of an alcove. "Susan, good to see you." He hadn't regenerated since the last time I saw him. He wore a green coat, a loose cravat, leather boots that went almost to his knees, and a knapsack across his shoulder. His hair was much shorter, and something about him seemed a little battered, as if he'd travelled a long way. Of course he had. He always had. But right now he looked as though he'd done it without the benefit of a TARDIS. He stepped towards me, offering a friendly embrace, but I stepped back. "What are you doing here?" "I came to see you," he said, as if it was absurd to think there might be any other reason. "Why are you creeping around in my flat while I'm not even here?" "I," he said, then looked at the spider on the table. "I was hiding from those." "Why," I replied, "are there any in here?"
"I thought I saw one," he said.
I told him about the swarms of spiders I'd seen in the street and how I'd knocked them out with the oscillator.
"Oh," he said, rather flatly.
"Why?" I said, feeling annoyed with him for not being more impressed, and then annoyed with myself for seeking his approval. "Should I not have done that?"
"No,
no, well done. I'll check if there are any still here." He drew his sonic screwdriver and swept it around the room. There didn't seem to be anything. I was still disconcerted about his sudden appearance. Admittedly, he did have a habit of turning up only in the midst of chaos, but there was still something odd about his behaviour, and I couldn't put my finger on it. I turned over my deactivated spider and tapped its surface. "Bring that over here," I said, meaning his sonic screwdriver.
"Why?"
he said. I reached out and took it from him, which I knew he didn't like. But I wanted to get to the bottom of this and didn't want to waste any time. I adjusted the settings and pointed the thing at the spider. "These things clearly aren't intelligent," I told him, as an iris shutter in the belly of the spider popped open. "I suspect they're being controlled from somewhere." He didn't say anything. I looked up at him and he shrugged. Unusual for him to offer no opinion. I changed the sonic settings again and pointed it back at the spider. "And it shouldn't be too hard to trace the signal back."
"Susan, don't."
I was right. It wasn't too hard. The readout of the sonic was able to give a very precise location for where the spider was being controlled from. It was Grandfather's bag. He pretended not to realise, so I pointed it out for him.
"Oh," he said, as if surprised. "Someone must have sneaked the control device into my bag."
"No, they didn't. You made these and you're controlling them."
"I wouldn't say control exactly. They just sort of scuttle and leap."
I demanded to know how many days he'd been skulking around here.
"I was going to come and say hello," he said, "once I'd sorted out the other thing."
"What other thing?"
"You weren't supposed to take care of the spiders so quickly," he laughed, stalling.
"Clever girl, clever girl." I was losing my patience and was all set to tear a strip off him, but then I had that hay fever feeling again, a slight pressure in my head, a watering of the eyes, and I saw a glow coming from the living room. I walked towards it and the pressure grew. The source of the glow was sitting in the middle of my floor, a white cube which would just about fit in the palm of your hand. Its surface and angles were clean and perfect, and it hadn't been there a minute ago. I knew what it was. A tesseract.
It was a message from Gallifrey.
I picked it up. I think he told me not to, but I wasn't really listening. I knew it was for me, and I knew it was the source of the hay fever feeling. The Tesseract was trying to tell me its message was urgent. The unpleasant feeling wouldn't go away until I opened it. It was a way of stopping the recipient from putting it off until later. I turned to Grandfather, who'd followed me through.
"Susan, don't open it," he said.
But his tone was despairing and sad, not commanding. What he meant was, "I don't want you to open it."
"Is that why you came here? To stop me opening it?"
He didn't say anything, but in my mind it was starting to fall into place.
"You built the spiders."
"To what?
To get me out of the house?"
"They couldn't hurt anyone."
"They caused mass panic. This is so irresponsible."
"I needed to keep you tied up a little longer this time," was his reply, followed by a wince as he realised what he'd said. He began to hurriedly speak to override the comment, but this time, more of it was falling into place.
"The asteroid and the custard."
"I wish I'd been here to see the custard," he said.
"Did it work?"
"Yes, it got everywhere. This isn't the first Tesseract they've sent, is it?" He shook his head.
"The others were returned. Undelivered."
I'd had the hay fever sensation both times when I'd got home, but there'd been no cube. Obviously, the sensation lingered a while in the air, even after it had been removed. Speaking of which, the sensation was becoming intolerable. I started to open the Tesseract.
"I'm assuming this is about you, then," I said.
"I wish it was," he replied hollowly. Then the message hit me, a lot harder than I was expecting. I saw everything that was happening to Gallifrey, the worst threat it had ever faced. We'd ignored them for so many years. When I left Gallifrey, I hadn't even heard of them before, and neither had Grandfather. But as time went by, we'd become more and more concerned. We'd broken our own policies in an attempt to stop them before they even began. But our efforts to stop them just made them hate us more. Even then, most people thought it would never come to this. It was inconceivable that they'd dare launch an attack of this scale. But the inconceivable had happened. And the box didn't just contain information. It was filled with dread, making me sick to my stomach. Everything was at risk. If we didn't stop them, nobody would. And then, from the dread, there came a sting of hope. A sense that victory would come if we all worked together. These were my call-up papers then. Gallifrey needs you to fight the Daleks. For the next few minutes while the message sank in, I wasn't really aware of anything. Eventually, I realised I was sitting down and Grandfather was bringing me a cup of tea. I took the cup from him. He sat opposite me and we sat in silence for I don't know how long. When I finally sipped the tea, I was surprised it had gone lukewarm.
"Did you get one of these?" I asked.
He laughed.
"Yes. They got desperate enough to ask me."
He looked at the floor.
"I said no."
"But surely nobody's beaten them more times than you have."
He sighed.
"This is a different sort of fight. It's getting very, very nasty very, very quickly. Emergency legislation, neutral territories annexed for their own good, the ends justify the means and so on. I'm having no part of it."
"So you're sitting it out?" I asked. He laughed.
"Hardly. I'm helping the people who are caught in the crossfire. That's keeping me busy enough. But they keep coming. They keep asking. I see they're being just as persistent with you."
I finished my tea. He looked edgy, anxious. He stood up.
"Look, I'll take you away, somewhere they won't find you. I've got an idea how you can hide." "I don't know if I want to hide. I'd feel a coward." Then travel with me again.
I don't have anyone right now. Please, Susan, just let me keep you safe.
I thought about it for a little while, staring at the tesseract, which was still in my lap. Eventually I said, "All right." His face broke into a grin. "Good. I want to take a few things with me. Do you have any boxes in the TARDIS?" "Of course," he said, heading for the door. "I'm parked in the quad."
"Under Ian and Barbara's tree?" He stopped and smiled. "That's right. Back in a jiffy."
And he walked out of the door. When it opened, I heard the noise of the people I'd brought back here. I'd forgotten about them entirely. Well, I'd leave it to Grandfather to explain the spiders. I locked the door behind him, then I sat on the floor in front of the tesseract. I put my reply into it and sent it back. A few moments later, there was a knock at the door. I pushed the control that activated the entry screen, and an image of Grandfather appeared. He carried an old tea chest with the number 76 painted on the side.
"Open up," he said.
"No," I replied, and he looked confused. "I'm not coming with you," I explained. "I'm going to go and fight."
"No, you don't know what you're signing up to."
"I've already seen the Daleks off this planet twice. If Gallifrey loses this war, they'll come again. I can't just wait for it to happen. Not when I could be doing something to stop it."
"Susan, we need to talk about this. Let me in."
I could see he was already reaching into his pocket for his sonic screwdriver, but it was still on the kitchen counter, next to the robot spider. "Grandfather, no. A long time ago, you decided I was going to stay here. I didn't get a choice. I've had a good life on Earth, but I'm making the decision this time." A TARDIS was arriving in the corner of my room, its chameleon circuit disguising it as a wardrobe in a similar style to my coffee table and sideboard. Grandfather could hear it too, and although he looked a younger man than when we'd travelled together, he was a lot older. And at that moment, he seemed every year of it. In silence, we looked at each other through the small screen. "I'm sorry," I said to him at last.
"Susan, Susan, please."
"Don't be afraid for me," I said. "It's the right time. That's why they came for me now. They know I've done all I can here. You go and do what you need to, and I'll do what I need to. And one day, we'll see each other again. One day." I didn't wait to hear his reply. I opened the wardrobe door, stepped inside, and it closed behind me.